It's all right.
I can hear you.
It's okay.
It's good.
It's all right.
It's all right.
So this may not be one of our most stellar recordings ever. I've got a fever and like a summer cold, and I should be in bed.
Barely prepped. I spent all my time prepping my talk for next weekend, and that's not even done yet.
Yeah. So but we did want to get something out.
Because this is what we do.
Because this is what we do, and it's like I feel all week. Actually, I look forward all week to getting together to talk and put out a thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I've got you can make notes or what yeah, you know, and jump in, but I've got three articles that I wanted to talk about that are of various degrees of relevance to previous topics we've done recently. Mm-hmm. So one of them is from National Review, and this goes back to the Confederate monuments.
Oh, right.
Chat. Yeah. So this one is National Review published an editorial recently. Nordlinger.
Nordlinger.
Yeah. September 15th, 2017, called "Seeing the Confederacy Clear." Mm-hmm. And I'm going to quote a little bit from this here.
Yeah.
Because I think they're basically trying to establish that this is a dead horse.
Yeah, it's time to stop beating it.
And it's time to stop beating it, and it's time to stop defending it. And that's kind of fascinating because that's a sea change. And it may really not seem like much, but if you've followed the National Review and their bad takes and their dumb arguments for decades, you know, this is kind of substantial. So what was the Confederacy? This is not from the start of the article. This is from partway into it. Earlier this week, I recorded a podcast with George F. Will. What he said spoke for me. The Confederates tried to destroy our country. That's kind of a serious business. And they tried to destroy our country in the name of the ultimate human evil, which is the complete annihilation of freedom we call slavery. So there's no point in investing the lost cause with glamour and romance. It was an execrable movement with a hideous objective.
Yeah, there's that.
Yep. So let me skip forward a little bit. I should say the tone he takes in the article is quite funny, actually.
Yeah.
It's quite sardonic. It reminds me of what I did like about William F. Buckley, which was his sort of withering, you know, looking down the nose at people, at their dumb arguments, and like,
please.
You know, his sarcastic sense of humor.
Yeah, there's something to like. That was it.
Every so often, I'm reminded how bad slavery was. Consider, for generations, Americans had the right to own other people as chattels. They could work them, rape them, torture them, and kill them with impunity. Earlier this year, I interviewed George Walker, a nonagenarian American composer. His grandmother was an ex-slave. She had had two husbands. She lost the first when he was sold at auction. Yeah. Walker knew this grandmother very well. She never talked about slavery, ever. Except for one time when her grandson's curiosity got the better of him and he asked her about it. She uttered one sentence only. They did everything except eat us. Excuse me.
That's a pretty good summary.
That is the reality that the Confederates fought to preserve. That is the reality that they seceded from the Union to preserve. Dress it up all you want, states' rights and all, but that is the core of it. And I was just digging back into the history of Reagan's first address post-launching his campaign in Philadelphia.
Yeah.
Right. Not Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
Yeah. No. It's a different Philadelphia.
Where he was talking about states' rights. And this is what he was talking about. This was the dog whistle pandering that he really should be remembered for, but often isn't.
Yeah, there's that.
So down to the very end. For ages, the Republican Party was known as the Party of Lincoln. I don't want to dig too deep into Lincoln's actual take on slavery, but
no.
It would be a shame if it became the party of Lee. Several months ago, my colleague Tim Alberta interviewed Patrick J. Buchanan, who posed in front of a picture of Lee and held a replica of Lee's revolver in his hands. Yippee, PJB ran for president a couple times, coming up short. The way he put it to Alberta was, the ideas made it, but I didn't.
Yeah.
These days, when you speak as I have, sounding like a leftist, in other words,
right,
you're accused of, quote, moral preening and virtue signaling, often by people who have spent their careers morally preening and virtue signaling. I don't care, frankly. I will not let my hatred of political correctness and love of tradition obscure the Confederacy or perfume its symbols. If that makes me a bad conservative, well, tough. You can have your stars and bars and your Lee. I'll have my stars and stripes and Lincoln. But can't you have them all? Aren't they all part of American history and the American family? Of American history, yes. But the Confederates wanted out of the family, right? And for what reason, fundamentally? And then his last line really made me want to crow, kind of, oh, this is a lousy issue. I will not be waiting in again, I hope, anytime soon.
Yeah.
Basically saying this is a swamp.
There's no reason to go here.
That the right has been stuck in and defending and should stop because it gets everyone dirty.
Well, no, and frankly, really, frankly, for the American right, it's an absurd thing to defend in treason.
And also, well, because they see treason so many places on the left, you know. They see Chelsea Manning and, you know, as treasonous, et cetera. Snowden and
treasonous. Try him.
I would say Assange, but he's not an American citizen, so he can't technically be.
But they want to prosecute him for something.
They want to prosecute him, yes.
Or, you know, I don't know.
And I'm not going to.
Was someone calling for extrajudicial killing of Assange?
Sure, of course they do. And I'm not going to get into defending Assange right now. I can't really full throatedly defend Assange, but yes. And then, but he made a good point earlier. We claim this is the party of freedom, right?
Right.
So, I mean, it's. On its face, it's farcical
to defend slavery.
To defend the history of slavery for a party that was all about freedom.
Anyway. Ostensibly, yeah.
Okay, so I've got another piece too. We talked a little bit about the Grenfell Towers. Actually, when I had to go answer the door last week, you were continuing to talk about neoliberalism and about Grenfell Towers. And there's a... there's a comment in the a blog called an online opinion site, The Outline, and it's about Megan McArdle, and it's called Megan McArdle Has a Lot of Bad Ideas.
Megan or Megan?
Who knows?
Okay.
And this is from September 21st.
Right.
So it outlined a couple of her bad ideas. But then it talked about, this was recent too, and I've heard other people talk about this. I know Chapo Trap House had a take on it, and I read it in the original, in Bloomberg, because she publishes opinion pieces in Bloomberg. But it's McArdle's most iconically wrong-headed effort for Bloomberg this year was a June column on the Grenfell Tower fire in London, which killed 60 people and left hundreds homeless. Titled Beware of Blaming Government for London Tower Fire, McArdle flippantly attempts to concern troll one of the most cut and dry examples of the human cost of post-recession austerity. McArdle correctly acknowledges that Grenfell might not have claimed as many lives if regulators had required sprinkler systems in the tower, but then proceeds to brainstorm bizarre hypotheticals in which installing sprinklers might have actually killed more people. Every dollar the government spends on installing sprinkler systems cannot be spent on the health service or national defense or pollution control. Would more lives be saved by those measures or by sprinkler systems in public housing? It's hard to say, she writes. It's worth noting that this abomination of an opinion piece was published before many Grenfell victims were pulled from the smoldering rubble that was literally their entire lives. It's possible, quote, it's possible that by allowing large residential buildings to operate without sprinkler systems, the British government has prevented untold thousands of people from being driven into homelessness by higher housing costs.
Oh, that's thoughtful.
This is what passes for a thoughtful take In neoliberalism, and it's just a hair, maybe not even distinguishable in some cases, from a libertarian take.
She's very libertarian.
Where it comes down to, where everything comes down to cost, and where regulation is only permissible, I don't know, when is it permissible? For protecting property.
Protecting property and reducing costs. Well, I guess here's the thing, though, about that kind of take or whatnot.
Yeah.
Like, the title is not to blame government.
Yeah, right.
But it failed to protect its citizens.
The government failed to protect its citizen, one of its few legitimate roles.
Well, its few legitimate roles.
Right.
It failed to engage that, so I'm not sure what else, other than holding them accountable, there is to do.
This isn't so very different from the Flint situation.
Like, well, yeah, but
it would have cost more.
No, they had one job.
Yeah,
they had one job.
Right.
You know,
the thing that makes this so surreal also is that this is all. I mean, the housing situation in London is. It's psychotic.
It's revolting.
It's and all of these, I mean, these buildings are being bought up by outside investors, and huge amounts of London properties are actually sitting vacant as investments.
As investments.
Just having sort of minimal maintenance done to keep them from deteriorating.
Right.
While the people that have purchased them, you know, various oil magnates and whatnot, right. don't even live there.
Don't live there. I have no plan to live there.
All
it's
of
just
that.
Speculation.
All of that. Is the kind of thing that regulation is for.
Yeah.
You know, that, in other words, she's accepted, in writing a piece like this and accepting this, she's kind of accepted that the market is in charge of everything and we just serve it.
Right.
And, you know, and to interfere with the, you know, the working out of the free market, highest bidder, whatever.
It'd be like polluting nature.
It's wrong. That would be wrong. That would be like a violation of our religious principles.
Well, and you'll hear this over and over again. It's like violating nature.
Mm-hmm.
Like, yeah. Well, you can't cut that tree down because, you know, nature.
Because the free market always ultimately works in everyone's best interests. You know, even if we have these little oopsies and hiccups along the way. Yeah. No, I mean, we should be very clear. A lot of people died here in a really disgusting situation, a really nasty display of putting profits over people, saving money, refusing to enforce safety regulations. And it was appalling. And there's no way that you can write a take on it like that and not be a shit, you know?
Yeah, there really isn't.
There really isn't. And, you know...
I read that, and I was like, really?
She's making all the assumption that everything is, it's all a zero-sum game, right?
Yeah.
You know, somewhere, you know, these people that own this real estate, it's for them, it's not a zero-sum game.
No, it's not.
So how does it get to be a zero-sum game where the people who have to give up safety are the people who died?
Who died, right. Well, and I think there's just something about it that's so, like, you're going to say that with a straight face?
Yeah, the people who couldn't have a little extra money spent on them to enforce safety regulations.
So they could stay alive?
Yeah.
And with a straight face, we're going to, like, discuss this as a cost-benefit analysis.
Cost-benefit analysis.
With a straight face. I mean, it's kind of like saying, so I could feed the kids today, but, you know, that would cost money.
And we're presuming that the London real estate market is all... proceeding by the working out of a very fair and balanced, straightforward free market economy.
Yeah. Totally.
Yeah. All right. I have one more piece I want to quote from here.
Okay.
And this is just a quick news take. This is from The Guardian, Nigerian edition. Not the version in West African Pigeon.
That's great, though.
Which I started reading.
It's a little
reading.
Bit more honest, actually.
I started reading... no, that's not The Guardian. That's the BBC.
The BBC
I'm
Pigeon
Service.
Yeah. Pigeon Service.
There's a BBC service that translates some of their material and makes it available, both audio, video, and print in is it Nigerian Pigeon?
Nigerian Pigeon.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's, if you haven't seen it, you should go listen to it. It's pretty amazing.
Well, no, what I really most enjoy about the Pigeon service is that it really seems to present the news more honestly.
Well, I think that the Pigeon, because it's a pigeon, it has a somewhat more limited vocabulary and somewhat less nuance to the language,
right,
which means that you have to boil things down to this simple honesty,
right,
which is hilarious. Anyway,
yeah,
I'm not going to try and read this in Pigeon, but this is Obama begins lucrative turn as Wall Street speaker.
Yeah.
The former U.S. president will appear Monday, this was dated September 20th, before a who's who of the U.S. healthcare industry at a conference to be held next week by the New York trading firm Cantor Fitzgerald, according to two sources with knowledge of the matter. He will deliver remarks before answering questions from the audience, they said, on condition of anonymity.
Yeah, I wouldn't complain about that.
Obama will discuss his signature 2010 healthcare reform legislation, known as Obamacare, which Republican lawmakers are still working to dismantle after several failed attempts. According to a person briefed on Obama's planned appearance, he will be paid about $400,000.
Is that all? Come on, I could have done better than that.
I've taken a vow not to mention Hillary.
You just did.
No.
They're going to be president.
It's interesting to note now that to note in passing that the man, of course, was paid more. In August, Obama addressed a New York gathering held by the Chicago private banking and wealth management firm Northern Trust. Panelists at that event, according to the firm's website, included billionaire former New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg, Chief Microsoft Cybersecurity Advisor Jonathan Troll, and IBM General Manager for Blockchain Technology.
Wait, is the guy's name really Troll?
Troll.
Oh, Troll, not Troll. You. Oh, yeah. Okay.
Mary Weck. True to his values, Obama received $400,000 for his Northern Trust appearance, according to Bloomberg News, which also reported Monday that the former president had made a similar appearance this month at the private equity behemoth Carlyle Group.
Mm.
So I don't know if he's still involved, but the Carlyle Group was heavily stuffed with Bush family members.
Yeah.
And yeah. Was Romney? I wouldn't be surprised.
Yeah, no, Romney was there.
Okay. I've forgotten some of the details since I was deep into the run-up to the Iraq war.
Yeah, no.
Skipping ahead a little bit. So that's 1,200,000 or 1.2 million right there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Since leaving office, President Obama has spent his time doing public and private events, both paid and unpaid, that are true to his values and his record, Kevin Lewis, an Obama spokesman, told AFP.
I would have to agree.
Consistent with that, his paid speeches in part have allowed President Obama to contribute $2 million to Chicago programs offering job training and employment opportunities to low-income youth.
See, I told you it trickles down.
It trickles down.
It all trickles down.
If Obama wants to promote a program to assist Chicago area low-income youth, he could create and promote a program to assist Chicago area low-income youth. He could open it.
Appearances.
He could open it to small donations. He could show up and play basketball at these events with kids, right? I mean, what would the optics for that would be fantastic. He could accept small donations from all over. He could give talks for that thing. He could, you know, it would be a big thing. It would be, you know.
It would be amazing.
It would be amazing.
Yeah, but he's not going to do that.
No, he's not.
Because that's not what he's about.
That's not what he was ever about.
Yeah. And so I don't know. I can't even with some of the folks who are like, oh, he's gone.
I miss him so much.
I'm like, well, okay.
All right. Anyway.
Whatever works for you, babe, you know?
I just couldn't let this go by without comment.
Yeah, no. Yeah. No, I got nothing nice to say about Obama. So I just don't say anything because I got nothing nice to say.
Okay, there's more in this article. You can Google it or whatnot, find it for yourself. But we're gonna move on.
Actually, I think that presents an excellent segue, though.
Good, good.
Because the reason I have nothing nice to say about Obama is because he's a right winger, and we talked last week about the difference between right wing and left wing, conservative and liberal. He's not conservative, but he's definitely right wing. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Right.
In that he's clearly sitting on the side of the aristocracy. And I know that in the United States, it's a little confusing or seems
strange to talk about
to talk about the aristocracy. So I will substitute the word elite for aristocracy for an American context.
Not really a substantive difference, though.
There's no substantive difference. I mean, we like to believe that our elites are not aristocratic and hereditary. And I guess if that fairy tale is good for you, you should continue with that. But that's needs to be filed with the tooth fairy.
Yeah, you know, George W. Bush pulled himself up by his own bootstraps.
I tell you, you know, he turned himself around and reduced his drinking dramatically with very minimal outside assistance.
Yeah, only
I will give him that.
Only minimal government intervention.
Very little.
Okay.
So, but yeah, no, we've got this sort of absurd. I mean, I want you to just kind of think about.
He was a successful baseball team owner.
That actually wasn't.
Oh.
Yeah. Okay. Just kind of think about the names we have in politics in the United States.
Right.
And, you know, Romney was running for election. His father was the governor of the state of Michigan.
Sure.
I mean, so people that have presence in politics. Just keep that presence in politics.
We have political dynasties now.
Now, right now.
Yeah, and you know, Chelsea's now giving speeches.
Giving speeches, getting paid, making paid appearances. The generation, you know, another generation of Clintons moves forward.
Yeah.
In our own representative district here, I think I'm terrible. I'm dyslexic, so forgive me. It's either 15 or 51 here in Washtenaw County. Dingell has represented this district for the last 84 years.
Wow. Yeah.
I don't know. The United States is, 220? Yeah. So just, I mean, really, this. So if you're under this illusion that our elites are not hereditary, just like an aristocracy, you should be disillusioned with that.
Yeah.
It's time.
Yeah.
So we have.
It doesn't work exactly the same way here as it does in Britain.
No, it's very formalized and it's explicit in Britain.
Yeah.
Which makes it, frankly, when things are explicit, it's easier to attack them.
Mm-hmm.
It's easier to talk about them. It's easier to address them when it's explicit.
Sure.
So when the law is that, you know, the king and the queen don't pay any taxes but get all these tax benefits.
You can say, hey, it's not fair that this is the law.
But this is the law. That's not fair. Look at this. Right. See how unfair it is.
Right.
And people can be like, yeah, well, or make whatever argument they want to make.
Right.
But it's there in black and white. And now you can talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
None of the rules that we have here are explicit or even written down anywhere.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which actually makes it much, much harder to engage and do anything about. So, back to what I'm even talking about, how Barack Obama is a right winger because he's on the side of the elite in the United States.
And in that case, that's largely the capitalists.
That's largely the capitalists. How could it be anything else?
Right.
Because they're the people who have capital.
Right.
So, you know. And I am not immune or unable to comprehend why people are right wing, because make no mistake, the Democrats, there's a word for them, the Democratic faithful in the last election, those people were really operating from a right wing place, right? That they needed to side with the elites,
yes,
to stay safe. And largely,
that was how it was framed and set up.
As I was framed, it's how it was set up, because the only way for us to stay safe is to stick with the elites that we know that will maintain the order that we can tolerate.
And specifically to avoid to help us stay away from dangerous populism.
From dangerous populism, dangerous uprisings, dangerous revolt.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I'm not pretending that I don't understand that those things can be dangerous. And I don't pretend to not understand that releasing some of our American demons is not going to be pretty.
No.
I'm not trying to say that that's not true.
No, well, and we're seeing them coming out.
We're seeing it. And I want to draw a small distinction. Frequently, the fact of them coming to the surface, people describe as if it's come into existence at this moment.
Sure, right.
And I think that's really a fundamental mistake. It's a critical error.
Charlottesville just gave these people a voice. They felt empowered. They felt like it was safe to come out.
It's not
like they haven't been there.
No, they've been there. They've always been there. Mm-hmm. They didn't go anywhere.
I mean, the exact details of the way, you know, the alt-right, you know, is manifesting.
Yeah, the details.
Now is different.
It's different, but it's details.
It's wrapped in internet culture and all that, but it's the same.
It's the same thing.
Core.
And it didn't come from nowhere, like spring from the ground.
No, these ideas fester.
They fester. They've been there the whole
generationally.
Time.
Generationally.
And I think it's important to understand that they didn't... American white liberals saw it for the first time post-election.
Many of them, it seems like many of them did, yeah.
Well, like for this is the first time they've seen it. Yeah. And they were literally unable to perceive or notice it previous to November of 2016.
If they had been able to perceive it prior to the election, they wouldn't have acted so shocked.
So shocked, right.
By the election.
But this impulse, and that's the right wing impulse with which I can have any sympathy.
Mm-hmm.
The idea that the wealthy people need more of the wealth really just seems so absurd to me. I can't even comprehend that as a thing.
If you know what the numbers actually look like as far as wealth inequality, income inequality, and all, it's so psychotic that how could you possibly advocate that, you know,
we give the wealthy more?
Yeah.
That's bizarre. I don't understand why someone would have that impulse. I know that people do. Yeah. I just don't understand how they come to that.
We'll have to get someone on our show.
Yeah, I would really like to. I'd like to talk to someone and learn. But this impulse that avoiding the chaos, the violence, and the upheaval of revolt,
mm-hmm.
I get that that's terrifying. I'm not confused about that being terrifying. I'm not confused. I mean, really, when you describe the French Revolution, the details of it.
It's still pretty vivid.
It's still pretty vivid, and it was horrific.
Game of Thrones had nothing
on the French Revolution.
Like the Red Wedding had nothing on the French Revolution.
No.
Yeah.
Now, there's a great... story about some nuns that were taken to be to the guillotine,
mm-hmm.
and they were all singing praises as they went, and I think there were dozens of them, and they were so like there's this chorus going right, and as they chop off heads, it gets quieter and quieter and quieter until it ends, and it's really
George R.R. Martin actually was a big fan of medieval history and the War of the Roses and all these historic events, and that's, you know, his ideas didn't come from nowhere. He was inspired by real medieval history,
right? Which is gruesome, and horrific. And really, these gruesome periods are part of the revolt process.
Yeah, they can be.
They can be. And I think the thing, if there's anything to celebrate about the United States,
mm-hmm.
I think the idea that we ostensibly change leadership every 4 years without violence, that's something to celebrate, right?
Yeah.
If there's something to celebrate, and if we actually change leadership. But that concept of doing it without violence, that's legitimately new.
It actually still has a lot of the world, I think, viewing us as an experiment.
Much so.
Yeah.
Because that's kind of sort of unheard of.
And wondering if the experiment's going to last.
Implode.
I'm wondering.
Yeah. So the impulse is, you know what, let's just do what the elites want as long as we have a place to eat and food to eat.
Mm-hmm.
And just stay safe. That's not insane.
No.
That's not just like some lunacy. And that's what I think is the real impulse of these right-wing movements, which, make no mistake, the Democratic Faithful of 2016 was a right-wing movement.
Yeah.
And if you doubt that, I want you to look at the number of 2012 Romney voters that voted alongside Democratic faithful. When you look at those numbers, you see the nature of what happened. That was a right-wing impulse. And really, it's motivated by, I think, is a very legitimate fear. And it's motivated by this clinging to safety. But I think, and actually, that's the other thing I think, is a lot of Americans, this is the reason Americans aren't prone to revolution. Our elites have kept us reasonably well fed and housed, at least well enough that we aren't just waiting for an opportunity to, for revolt.
Except that
we're edging over that line right now.
We're edging over that line.
Right. Right now. And the further we go over that line, to be honest, I'm not sure what people without any other power have.
As far as
like historically,
any way of affecting change.
Of affecting change. No, what else is there?
Right.
Which is the other thing I want to talk about today. And I think that I've exhausted what I've got already prepared or in mind, is that brings me to Antifa. Mm-hmm. There's all this it's all this claptrap online, all this claptrap all over wherever you go about how, well, you know, Antifa is just as bad as, you know, the Nazis.
There's actually a subreddit called R Antifa, and I subscribe to it to see what they were posting, and it's all mockery. It's actually all mockery and ridicule and memes ridiculing Antifa.
Well, yeah.
So I thought, oh, neat. Is there actual discussion of their?
Yeah, no.
Yeah,
no. Because.
Well, because they're anonymous, right?
You know, it's just a cesspool.
And they don't want to describe. You know, they don't want to set up a paper trail of, you know, or online trail of where they're going to be meeting and organizing.
Right. Again, for the record, if you're part of the resistance, you don't tell anybody.
I am with the resistance. Definitely with the resistance.
Yeah. So, this idea that it's sort of like, there's some kind of equivalency thing. Well, first, let me explain. For those of you who have some kind of, like, all you know about Antifa is that they punch Nazis, right? That's all you understand about Antifa. Maybe let me give you just a little background. That it's Antifa stands for anti-fascist, which I think should be enough information right there.
You would think.
I really feel like that's enough, like I've said enough. But they're anti-fascists. They've been around close to a century. Mm-hmm. As fascism emerged in Europe, these sort of anarchist groups emerged to respond to, and fascism, this marriage between the government and the state, is usually, every time I've seen it, every historical example we have, it's usually sort of pulled through parliamentary government by ethno-nationalism. Mm-hmm. So like the little hook, the cherry, the carrot that pulls fascism through and gives it legal cover is ethno-nationalism.
Yeah, it's
here we have the Klan.
The National Socialist Party. Again, the more important aspect of that was the nationalism.
Nationalism.
Yeah, we mentioned that.
So so when those things emerge, and mind you, this ethno-nationalism, soundly condemned by the church, by the way, is a thing. It's not like it's part of the human condition. Sure. People have this commitment to their ethnicity, to their
The alt-right is preaching literally for a white ethno-state.
Ethno-state, yeah.
Yeah.
So when that's emerged, anarchist groups have formed a collective to respond. And that's happened in a variety of ways in a variety of places. And here's the thing. It's always a response to a threat of violence.
Mm-hmm.
Now, mind you, violence is very intoxicating.
Sure.
And you'll see and you'll read and you'll hear all kinds of what I want to call blustering.
Yeah.
But I don't want to give violence cover per se. But you'll hear all kinds of blustering about how we'll, you know, take them down, et cetera, et cetera. But anybody who's going into a fight,
there's a big difference between talking about fighting and what happens when you actually get punched in the face.
Exactly.
And I've a few times in my life I've been on the giving and receiving end of the punch in the face, and you know, your actual battle plan does not really survive contact with the enemy.
No, it doesn't. Almost never, you know?
Yes.
Yeah, unless you got lots of troops and you're not doing the fighting. That's right. The only way your battle plan survives.
Right, right.
So, you'll hear and read all kinds of things. So I'm sure there's some meme you've read, like, this is incitement to violence and it's terrible. Yeah, whatever, you know. Mm. But Antifa, as it exists and as it has existed, is a response to racial violence.
Mm-hmm.
So someone is going to show up. I mean, really, let's be clear about Charlottesville in particular.
Yeah.
White racists were going to a black project to go beat people up and forcibly evict them from their homes.
Yeah.
Now, interestingly, before Antifa ever got there, the black community took care of its own.
Yeah, yeah.
But Antifa was there to respond to that threat.
They were there to respond, and by all accounts, the police was largely standing by and doing nothing, even when people were pulling guns and attempting to fire them.
Yeah.
That's some new detail that's come out.
Yeah, that's next level,
about, though. About Charlottesville.
Yeah. So white bigots were going to attack a poor black community.
Mm-hmm.
And Antifa were the people who were like, well, let's show up and play on their team. Not the white bigot team.
Right.
Let's play on the poor black team and maybe even the odds. And that's what Antifa is about.
And they are there in many cases when the police is not intervening.
It's not intervening.
Right.
You know, people are being injured, yeah. You know. And these are the folks who are intervening.
There are stories and reports from Charlottesville of several people there saying, Antifa, saved my life.
You know? Saved my life.
Yeah.
These people were coming at me with clubs and fists. Right. And Antifa was there, not afraid to use violence to respond.
Yeah. There's a recent piece, a bit circulating, where a guy was traveling on was this in Seattle? I think it was in Seattle.
Yeah.
Guy was traveling on a bus or something with a Nazi related insignia on an armband.
Mm-hmm.
And word went out on social media, and this guy actually got beat up and then knocked out and mm-hmm. posting a picture of this guy getting punched and left on the ground.
Oh yeah, knocked out cold.
Now, I can't advocate for that exactly. I think if you do something like this, there should be some legal consequences.
Yeah.
I would say like a fine of maybe as much as $12-$15. And maybe an anger management class should be required.
Yeah. We've got good tools for that.
Yeah.
For managing that kind of anger.
Right.
And I'm not really down with organizing internet mobs into real life action.
No, that's not exactly the reality we want.
No. But here's the thing. We are left in a... If you support the existence of a police force,
yeah.
If you think that in
a militia of any kind,
a militia of any kind,
constitutional, duly constituted, right. Designated, whatever, volunteer,
if philosophically, you comprehend
sure
that
we need that.
We need that. Then you comprehend why Antifa exists.
Yeah,
you're not confused. If you understand why we have police, then you also understand why Antifa exists.
Yeah.
And you may not know that you understand it, but you do. Because when people, like if someone comes to my house, people are always talking about, oh, you know, anti-police brutality people, you want the police, you'll call the fish people to call if like someone comes to your house with a gun.
No, actually.
Actually, no. But if someone comes to your home threatening you with violence, you call the police because you want someone armed to protect you.
Yeah. Now, if you're a person of color, I think, honestly, in many cases, that's the last person you're going to call.
Yeah. So this idea that these marginalized communities that really can't rely on the police for that protection should not have some kind of semi-organized group willing to protect them.
Yeah.
It's kind of absurd if you embrace the police
the notion of the police
because that's how they're functioning,
and
they're functioning as ad hoc police for people who are too marginalized to be protected by the police.
And maybe you don't really embrace that. I mean, people on the right, NRA fans, open carry fans and whatnot, seem to believe that you're safety is only ever your
Some of them seem
and
to
your
believe
family's
that.
Safety is your only ever your concern, and so you should be carrying, and right. and you should have guns in your home
now,
to protect your family.
That real that sliver,
yeah, yeah.
that is that really seems to embrace that and is also anti-police.
Yeah,
is actually fairly small. I see a lot of folks on the right who embrace that but are also pro-police.
Sure,
and I don't follow.
The Venn diagram is not very.
I'm not sure I get that.
Yeah.
And there are folks on the left who reject the police, so I can see them rejecting Antifa.
Yeah, there are leftists who carry guns. Yeah.
Certainly, certainly. Yeah. Which actually makes a lot of sense to me.
Yeah, but I mean, the whole Black Panther
thing. Yeah, I get that. I'm not confused. Yeah. But it's not my thing. It's not my calling, but I understand.
No.
So
I don't think it makes us any safer to have a gun in our home.
I mean, just really, the science is clear on that,
yeah.
actually. So the deal with Antifa, I think if you need to understand what's going on with Antifa, is that they are a police force for the marginalized.
Yeah.
And they emerge as needed to do what they can figure out to do. And you may think what they're doing is wrong or the wrong thing they do or a poor strategy. You may think all those things and you're free to think that. But understand that their role is not actually, just like the police's role is not actually the same as the role of the criminal.
Yeah.
Even though they both may both be very violent.
Yeah. If
the roles aren't the same.
It's also, I mean, if you're a middle class white person fretting about Antifa, keep in mind, they're not really for you.
Mm-mm.
Right.
They're not a police force for you.
Yeah.
You got one already.
Right.
They're for the people who don't have one.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
So I think that's an important way to understand Antifa. And really, the police are a police force for the right wing.
Mm-hmm.
And Antifa is a police force for the left wing.
Mm-hmm.
And we can debate whether what we think about police forces. And I think that's a really valid conversation.
Yeah.
But that's what it looks like on each side. So it's much more appropriate to compare Antifa to the police than it is to compare Antifa to the Klan.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's a much fairer comparison. And then I think you're making equivalent conversations, equivalent arguments.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And just like the police should not abuse their power.
Yeah.
No one should abuse their power.
Sure.
This
is why, I mean, I'm half joking when I say that punching a Nazi should carry a significant fine.
Scary fine. Right.
But, because I'm trying to say, trying to make a real moral equivalence between,
it's absurd.
Between murdering a person to promote the idea of white ethno-state versus punching someone who's trying
that person who's trying to murder someone.
Right. There's not a moral equivalence.
There's no moral equivalence to be had.
So let's not pretend.
Let's not pretend that.
Yeah.
Or try to front that we can't start the conversation there.
But, personally, I'm a fan of nonviolent protests and whatnot, but it doesn't mean I'm not going to punch someone who's trying to harm my family right in front of my eyes.
Exactly. Well, no, and I...
Even if I'm not very good at it.
To be clear, I, for a long time, described myself as a pacifist.
Yeah, yeah. I would have described myself, like, back in high school as a pacifist.
Right. And it grew out of my anti-nuclear beliefs. That I really just kind of embraced pacifism.
Mm-hmm.
It was actually after I became a parent and I saw someone kind of being sketchy around one of my children.
Yeah, yeah.
I realized in that moment that I'm just not a pacifist.
Yeah, well, you realized that that you had it in you to be a tiger mom in the sense that you might have decked the guy.
I might have decked that guy.
And not felt bad about it.
Not felt bad. Not held back.
And that was like a revelation to you.
It was a deep revelation.
Yourself.
It's like, oh.
Yeah.
I really had to reevaluate myself and who I thought I was.
No, I mean, I didn't have that experience exactly, but realizing that I could fight back, against the bully and actually score some punches was a revelation to me. I'm like, oh, wow, okay. That worked, huh?
Okay. I think I really can't claim to be a pacifist when I know that if my children are threatened, if my family is threatened,
you would defend them.
I would defend
violently
them.
If necessary.
If I had to,
yeah.
And that's the truth.
No, I don't. Anyone who's experienced road rage, I don't think can call themselves a pacifist.
Right? No, you really can't. But that said, that doesn't mean that I don't think pacifism and nonviolence are poor strategies or even
Right.
Maybe secondary. I think they, and this is partly a function of my economic privilege to think of nonviolence as a good strategy.
As an option. Oh, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. If you're the people living in that housing project that's being invaded literally by neo-Nazis.
Yeah.
You don't get the privilege of let's see if we can sit down with them and negotiate.
Well, let's see if we can, like, I don't know, link arms and.
Yeah. Right.
Just stand here nonviolently.
Yeah.
They're carrying automatic weapons, assault rifles coming to our homes. You know, that's not necessarily an option.
Right.
Right. So when I think, this is the thing I really think about nonviolence, right? I think what ends up happening with nonviolence, as powerful a strategy as it is,
mm-hmm.
it ends up being a cudgel against the oppressed who choose not to use it. And they're only ever making an informed decision about using it because they're the oppressed and they know how much violence will cost them. They're not confused.
How much it'll cost them.
Yes, yeah, the oppressed right. are not confused about how much using violence will cost them.
In the public opinion.
In every respect.
In, you know, court.
In court, et cetera.
In their future job prospects.
If there's anything they're clear about yeah, that.
Yeah, even losing their vote, right. you know.
So if they choose to use violence...
Or maybe citizenship in some cases.
Right?
Yeah, yeah.
They're doing it with all the information.
Yeah.
So yeah. I never want to be in the camp that denounces the oppressed for defending themselves as they see fit.
Be like, well, look at those idiots.
Look at those poors out there defending themselves. Yeah. I mean, you know, I'm not ready
if
to
If only
go
they
there.
Would just read the National Review.
They would only just read the National Review and maybe stand silently.
Yeah, link arms and sing hymns.
And sing hymns, you know. I don't know, maybe they're not religious. I don't know. I don't know what's going on with them, but I know they're making decisions guided by what they know.
Yeah, which is more than us.
Which is more than us about their own lives. So,
all right.
That's the word on Antifa for me.
Okay, cool. All right, I'm about ready to fall down. I'm sweating and shaking.
Yeah, and I've got to go to mass. It's time.
I'm gonna lie down and sleep and try and burn out the rest of this cold so I can work tomorrow. But
because capitalism.
But we did want to get through. We did want to get a conversation recorded. Get something out there. So. If you stuck with us through all this and listened to it, thank you very much for listening.
Thank you. Have a great week.
Bye-bye.